At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I welcome my colleagues, Andrew McCarthy of National Review Online, Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness, to discuss the initiative by legislatures, Democratic legislatures, in these last days to change the makeup of the Supreme Court, to add seats to the Supreme Court. Now 9, the proposal by Mr. Markey of the Senate, for example, Mr. Nadler of the House, is to go to 13. Why 13? Because theoretically, 4 more justices would give Mr. Biden a chance to put 4 more liberals on the court. You see, 4 plus 3 equals 7. That outvotes the 6 votes that Mr. Nadler and Mr. Markey maintain are conservative on the court. That's their counting. However, Andy's reporting on this takes us to the year 1869, a troubled year in American history following the Civil War, in the midst of the Klan riding roughshod over the South, the former Confederacy, the deployment of American troops, Union troops into the South, a troubled, troubled year. However, that was the year that the Supreme Court fixed 9 seats. Andy, I go there because we'd like to know what was the substance of that fix. Why? Because prior to that, there had been as many as 10 judges, sometimes 5, you report. But why 9 in 1869 and continuing? Good evening to you, Andy.
Good evening, John and Thaddeus. Well, the number of justices on the court, which is not fixed by the Constitution puts Congress in charge of not only the size of the court, but the existence of the federal court system and the jurisdiction of the federal courts. And the size of the Supreme Court had varied up and down, mainly due to political considerations, appointments, one side of our politics at that time wanting a smaller court, another side wanting a more robust one. In 1869, it went from 10 back to 9. And it, as you just pointed out, it had been 5 a relatively few years before that. And when they fixed it at 9, one of the reasons, not the only reason, was that there were 9 circuits by then in the United States. And circuits back then were not the same thing as the circuit court of appeals that or circuit courts of appeals that we have now. When the country first began, the 13 states, formerly colonies, were divided up into circuits, 3 circuits, and there were 6 judges on the Supreme Court. There were no court of appeals judges, no circuit judges, and there were lower federal district judges in certain places down the country. And what used to happen, John, is that the Supreme Court justices used to ride circuit so that 2 of them would police each of the then 3 circuits, and they would sit with the local district judge and decide cases. All very, very different from the way it is today and even the way it was in 1869. So when they went to 9 from 10 in 1869, there were 9 circuits, so the idea was going to be that there could be one justice for each circuit. But the reason for that consideration was because the Supreme Court justices were still riding circuit. They were still spending most of the year going to the circuit that they were responsible for and hearing cases. That hasn't really been the case. It stopped largely being the case in 1891 on the basis of an act of Congress. And the whole system was revamped between 1891 and 1911. So Supreme Court justices haven't ridden circuit in over a century. And there never was a real reason to have a formula, and there never was an understanding that there was a formula that said you had to have the number of justices on the Supreme Court the same as the number of circuits that we have in the country, which is now 13.
That is.
Andy, you've also written about the history of the court in the sense that court packing, as proposed by FDR, might not have become law, but it did have another effect. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, it didn't. We like to think of it on the conservative side as a complete flop, because even though FDR was at the height of his power, he wasn't able to pull it off, even though he had very commanding majorities among the Democrats in both houses of Congress. But the part of the story that doesn't get enough attention is that the pressure that Roosevelt put on the court caused it to change its jurisprudence, mainly about the progressive aspirations for big government in the United States. The court, basically from the mid-1930s going forward, or the late 1930s going forward, no longer defended the stringent restrictions in the Constitution that limit the federal government's powers vis-a-vis the states, and that limit the federal government's powers vis-a-vis the people. And as a result, we've had the imperial presidency. We've had a Congress that really doesn't acknowledge that any subject matter in American life is beyond their ability to regulate. And we've had the sprawling and metastasizing administrative state that is more intrusive than anything I think the framers could possibly have imagined for the federal government.
The politics of the Supreme Court, they're not obvious because the Constitution appears to give them their own, the court, its own branch administering the judiciary. However, there have been a number of instances that I've read about, and I'm sure there are many more because I've not studied this particular, where the court is heavily politicized. And the appointments we know are politicized, but so are decision making. The one I go to that is most recent and relevant is in 2012. There was the story at the time. We were not talking regularly at the time, Andy. More's the pity, but we were not. I remember the story in 2012. I think Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution and I discussed it, that the observation of the sudden switch that Justice Roberts made from judging Obamacare on the basis of the Commerce Clause to naming the Obamacare considerations mandate tax, that was understood by some to be the executive branch, in the person of Mr. Obama, intimidating the court. Does that have merit? And does that inform us that this is business as usual with the House and the Senate seeking to intimidate the court?
Yeah, I think it does have merit, John. And I certainly think it's particularly effective with respect to Chief Justice Roberts, who has shown himself over the years to be very politically aware and very risk averse, and to prefer that the court project an image of nonpartisan judging of legal cases rather than a conservative or conservative versus liberal divide. So I think that the pressure that gets exerted is more effective on Roberts, and that's a big deal because he's the Chief Justice and therefore punches above his weight on the court. The one thing I would just add to your comments and to Richard Epstein's analysis of this, with which I am familiar and completely agree, is that I think the court's a lagging indicator in the sense that what has changed in the last century plus is the legal profession and its understanding of itself and its role in American life. The academy at the law school level really teaches the law not as kind of the undergirding of ordered liberty in a democratic society. It teaches the law as a tool of social change, so that by the time these leading people in the legal profession get to sit on the federal courts and indeed on the Supreme Court, they are usually avatars of what the legal profession is at any particular moment in history. And this is a very activist, progressive legal profession. I would say outside of college professors, the American education profession, that the legal profession self-identifies more than any other in America as progressive.
That is.
Andy, doesn't Congress also have the ability to limit the jurisdiction of the court?
It sure does. Now, the interesting thing about that, Thaddeus, is that the court is so activist now that one of the reasons I think that the conservative Congresses shy away from using that congressional authority is they're afraid that the courts will try to invalidate it, which will, you know, which would be a very interesting thing. But, you know, if you look even at an unwieldy piece of legislation like Obamacare, John just mentioned Obamacare, there are numerous provisions in Obamacare that basically give the authority to make a decision to the Secretary of Health and Human Services and essentially cut the court out of the equation. So it's not only true that Congress has that authority over the court's jurisdiction, the left tends to use it when they want to make sure that something that they're writing is going to be applied as they've written it.
Mrs. Pelosi came out within 25 minutes of these statements by Mr. Markey and Mr. Nadler and said, not yet, not now. I'm paraphrasing. Why, Andy? It looked like they'd had a meeting beforehand and then their job was to be aggressive and her job was to say not yet. What did they achieve in that?
Well, I think they're achieving, John, in a more probably brass knuckles fashion, exactly what Biden's commission is supposed to achieve, which is, you know, the big cases in the Supreme Court are going to get decided in June and early July, and then the new term starts in October. What they want the justices to know is that they're watching and thinking about completely changing the Supreme Court as an institution, and they're hoping that that will have the intimidating effect on the court of narrowing the decisions that it does make and deeply affecting the decisions that it does make. And also importantly, the Supreme Court is in charge of its own docket. So what's important is not only how they decide cases, but what cases they decide to decide. And I think what the Democrats in Congress are obviously trying to do is affect and influence the way the Supreme Court goes about that work.
So, Andy, what Pelosi, Nadler, and Markey are doing is kind of a larger version of what Maxine Waters is doing in Brooklyn Center.
That's exactly right. They want to affect the outcome of what goes on in the courtroom by the brass knuckles tactics they use outside the courtroom. That's exactly right.
Let's move to the settledness of Florida, gentlemen, when we come back, because Governor Ron DeSantis, who's been singularly successful through the virus, keeping his state open and keeping his economy humming, has made remarks about the recent decision to move Major League Baseball's All-Star game from Atlanta to Denver. He has remarks about that decision and about other corporations that might enter into this idea that they can politicize decisions on the basis of their virtue. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.